Hello, and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Sinek, joined, as always, by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as Professor of Law at NYU and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, land use and the little guy. And Richard, today's episode is inspired by a piece that you had in the Wall Street Journal a few days ago on the ways government can abuse its ability to regulate land use. And interestingly enough, this involves two cases where you're lead counsel, not something we get to say very often. So two very different scenarios. I'll have you start by explaining the first case, which is taking place in Chicago, where you live for a big chunk of the year. This is a case involving the proposed construction of Barack Obama's presidential center on the South Side and the way the city has handled that project. So walk us through what's happening here, including there have been some developments even since you wrote the piece, and you're arguing about what's wrong with what's happened so far.
Well, this is, I would say, perhaps the greatest land grab in the history of the city of Chicago. The first thing to note is that the choice of the title Obama Presidential Center is not just a delicate piece of nomenclature. If they had tried to put a library on that site, they would have been barred by federal statute from doing anything because federal buildings can only be the library is only three stories tall. What they're trying to do is to find a narrow sliver of land between a busy street called Stony Island Avenue and a lagoon in Jackson Park, which was designed by Frederick Law Olmsted and, in fact, has some real powerful attractive versions. They want to put up a 225-story building, which looks like something like a pyramid and so forth, to house this particular operation. And in order to make it go, they're going to have to close down at least four roads. One of them is the Midway, a major east-west link. Another is Cornell Avenue, which is a six-lane highway over most of its duration, which has a lot of cars. And then two streets, Hayes and Marquette, further to the south, which will make it extremely difficult to navigate the South Side. In addition to that, that's going to cost about $150 million, the city says. The building itself is probably too heavy for the site, which is reasonably close to a lagoon and not that far from Lake Michigan, and it may have to be shored up on pylons, and the city is going to be on the hook for that as well. But the deal turns out to be is the Obamas get themselves a rather classy monument, but the traffic patterns are going to be disrupted for years. The aesthetics are very doubtful. The financial costs in the city are extremely high, and this, in fact, has given rise to a very consistent protest, which is joined not only by people who are very much opposed to Obama and his general political policies, but I would say, particularly on the South Side of Chicago, the majority of the opposition are people who are generally sympathetic to the president qua president, but very much oppose this. And many of them think that if he really pushes forward with this particular situation, he will tarnish his legacy. He's taken an extremely tough stand on this particular thing. He has not been willing, as a former community organizer, to do any community benefit agreements. The entire city council went along with him and created this situation. And we then tried to challenge this, a bunch of people. I was not involved at the trial, but the judge says, look, it's a carte blanche situation. Whatever the city legislature wants to do, you can deal with it at the polls, not otherwise. I got involved afterwards on the principal level when they wanted, quote unquote, a constitutional scholar to lead the case. And I'm working with an exceptionally able lawyer named Michael Rackless. And we had worked together before on these kinds of issues, most notably trying to stop the toilet bowl from being perched on the top of a world-class monument at the time, a Soldier Field. And this is an issue which has given rise to a lot of passion on the part of a lot of people. I think if it is allowed to go through, and I do not think it will go through for a whole variety of reasons, it would be a permanent blot on the South Side of Chicago. I regard this, and I think most people do, as perhaps the major civic issues that's facing the city. And on the last note, just this morning, there was an environmental assessment or a historical assessment, so forth, and the historical review, which was done by the traffic people, the highway people in the federal government, came to the conclusion that this had an adverse impact upon very many key historical sites. The federal review is not within the control of the city council, and it may well shift the balance in this case very sharply in the opposite direction. It's too early to tell, but this case is a long way from being over.
you said you got involved at the principal level. So just give us a sense of what the legal principles as you see it are that are under threat here.
Okay. I got involved at the appellate level. There was a trial. It was a very, you know, run by a bunch of other lawyers. They did a fairly thorough trial job. And I wrote an amicus brief in that particular case of no particular effect. And then the group, the pop group that Preserve Our Parks or Protect Our Parks, they said they'd like me to do it because they wanted a constitutional lawyer to do it. And I agreed to do this on a pro bono basis. So I'm not getting rich by this particular kind of thing. But I regard this case as so important in terms of the future of the city of Chicago. And indeed, it's a precedent for the way in which various kinds of public officials and former public officials can use their power, that it's certainly worth whatever personal sacrifice it takes from me. And it is an extremely time-consuming kind of thing to do, because like many high-profile litigation cases, it has an immediate news and political dimension, as well as having a long-term legal dimension. And as you know, whenever you try to go against local governments in land use disputes, the presumptions are always set against you. And so we have to have an exceptionally strong case in order to overcome the decision that was made on the other side. And frankly, I think given the way in which we've put together our record and with these recent developments that have taken place with the federal highway authorities, I think, in fact, that we can make that case and meet that burden.
And just to be clear, I mean, one of the underlying issues here, as you pointed out in your journal piece, is really that the Obamas received a treatment that almost nobody else in Chicago could have been expected to receive under these circumstances, right?
That is an understatement. The Lucas Museum was slated to go elsewhere in the park. It would have been a positive amenity, at least many people thought so. You didn't have to change roads. You didn't have to rip down historic sites and so forth. And it was blocked in the courts. If the Lucas had tried to put the their center in Jackson Park like the Obamas, it would have meant a mass revolt. Now, the interesting thing about the Obama stuff is there are two views on this. There are many people who believe that no private enterprise of that sort should ever go on public land. And there are other people who believe, well, put it on the right place. And there's an area just to the west of the University of Chicago called Washington Park with a much larger space where you could put a much better library in terms of its physical situation. And you have better connections to the Green Line and to the major freeways. And you don't have to tear up all sorts of roads to do it. The Obama Foundation itself actually preferred that site. And then the president and his wife decided to reverse that decision. So in our particular case, we are trying to stop Jackson Park. We are not trying to make any decision about whether it goes to Washington's Park or any one of a number of other sites on the south side of Chicago.
The other land use case that you're involved in is out in San Diego and involves a less visible party, at least thus far, we'll see, a family trying to build a home on a 7,000 square foot lot zoned for those purposes. And this is a struggle that has gone on for years with no real progress for this family because of an ongoing battle between them and the San Diego City Council. Walk us through this case.
Well, it would take a long time to walk through all the details on this case because this thing has gone through so many different ways. But let me start with the kind of essentials, and I'll give facts that may sound to people to be irrelevant at the outset or just ironic, but it turns out they actually have some real power. In about January of 2011, the Bottini family decided to purchase this land to build a house. It was not clear whether they wanted to live in it or to do it on spec or whatever it was, to sell it, but it cost $1.2 million. At that time, there was a wreck of a house that was on the site. And sure enough, since that was California, there were two attitudes towards said wreck. One was it's a public nuisance and you have to rip it down. And the other was it was a historical preservation and you had to keep it up. And the Bottinis did, I thought, a very wise thing. They said, if you think that this house is a historical preservation, it's not because of the lot it's on, it's because of its intrinsic features. Come along, you could take it away for free. And of course, they got no takers. Well, it took several years before they eventually were able to rip down the site. And then the question is how you evaluate the project. And the project got through all sorts of crazy litigation because there were people on the city council who said, in order to evaluate what this project is, you have to go back before the time that the house was ripped down to see what was going on. And you haven't done an assessment of what would have happened if the house had been allowed to remain. And that was eventually rejected in the courts after there was a very bitter dispute inside the city council where all the professionals inside the office were perfectly in favor of this house, but the political pressures were extremely strong. We go to court, and it turns out we win that particular battle. And then we go up on appeal and we lose the case. So the question is, why do we lose a case when in fact the permit seems to be ordered? Well, it turns out there's a doctrine of Supreme Court law called the Penn Central case. And it's a standard which says that the law will only protect landowners to the extent that they have investment-backed expectations in their property, and then only if there's not a sufficient justification that the state has in order to try to limit it. So it's called the Penn Central balancing test. Well, somehow or other, the balance was never taken in that case, because if it had been, what you want to do is to build a single-family home like everybody else. It's not like building Penn Central Tower on top of the Grand Central Station. It's certainly not like the Obama Center. And so, you know, it's a no-brainer. Then on the other side, there is no particular environmental issue that anybody could even think of. You're not ripping down roads. You're not blocking views or anything of the sort. So you win both ways. But in the Court of Appeal, what happened is the judge said, you know, this stuff about distinct investment-backed expectations, well, you don't meet that standard. Why? Because you did not have investment-backed expectations. When I tell this to most people, they kind of laugh and giggle in an embarrassment. They insist that I'm teasing them, but I'm not. And so long before I got into the case, Bottini and his very able internal lawyer, Albert Chang, wrote a petition for certiorari for the Supreme Court of California, and it was granted. And they called me up and said, could you help on this case? And, you know, I was very sympathetic. I said, look, it may be easier, quote unquote, if I write this thing. And we worked out a kind of a fee arrangement, which was, you know, basically this was not my commercial case. I did it because I thought it was really important to go on. And we write this brief, and I think it was a dynamite brief. And 3 weeks after it's written, the California Supreme Court unanimously sends down a one-sentence opinion which says, we believe that certiorari was improvidently granted in this case. You're out. So we didn't even get a chance to lose. We lost before we could lose. And I really felt rather bad. My great contribution as an appellate advocate is to get a case dismissed before you even get it to be tried. But in fact, the case has really extremely important issues. And now we're trying to work up a petition for certiorari before the United States Supreme Court. And we are lucky in the following regard. There is a recent case out there, which is named Nickby, the Township of Scott, which says, you know, property rights are kind of first-class rights. They're not second-class rights, like some people have said. And they've also said, we really think that you're entitled to get some kind of a federal forum on these sorts of cases. And in other situations, the Supreme Court is clearly taking dead aim at what they regard as excessive discretion on the part of local governments. So given the fact that this was such an extraordinary out-of-the-box mistake in everything, they have delays that go forever and use a preposterous standard, the hope is that we can galvanize the Supreme Court to looking at this, and I think that they perhaps could change things. Now, what do we want to change? This is not a revolutionary case. To make it very clear, all the Bottinis need is to have the standard Penn Central test applied, and they win in a walk. They don't have to change any law. The task here is to make sure that California follows federal law. And over the past many, many years, California courts have often been willing to, shall we say, put novel interpretations on federal standards in order to avoid their force. So this is long-term institutional arrangement. And even though the Bottinis are just one lot, there are probably thousands of lots like that in California and elsewhere, where you see these absolutely senseless prohibitions against new construction of the sort of things that, frankly, drive most people daft. And we are trying to capture that. In San Francisco, just to give the change in sentiment on this, everybody knows about NIMBY, not in my backyard. But now in San Francisco, you got YIMBY, yes, in my backyard, because you can show picture after picture of people living in RVs on streets and shanties and huts, because the lack of new construction all throughout the state has forced people to intolerable living conditions or incredible commutes or simply deciding to exit the particular state. And given the state of the California Supreme Court with its not going to give you cert on this particular case, and the bizarre position in the California legislature where land use reform of the sort that I'm talking about is an absolute anathema, it really is time for some kind of federal intervention.
I'm glad you mentioned San Francisco. That tees up quite well the last thing that I'll ask you today. These arguments about development and housing have become increasingly salient in recent years, especially in major urban centers like that. I mean, San Francisco, sort of first among equals. And you hear complaints about endless delays in permitting and construction, things just not being approved full stop within these cities or neighborhoods that are dead set against growth. And one of the complaints that you hear over and over again, on top of sort of the obvious ones, is just the sheer complexity of these processes. So you being the author of the book Simple Rules for a Complex World, let me ask you, are there simple rules for how government should ideally be approaching these issues around land use and building?
Well, there are certainly some very simple conceptions that could go a long way to stop this. For example, on the question of delays, one of the issues that the Bottini case raises is the issue of whether or not when you say to people, if you stop from doing anything with respect to your land, it's called a temporary total taking, whether there's an excuse for normal delays. And the interpretation that's given in California, the more we delay, the more normal delays are coming, so we could do this ad infinitum. Justice Rehnquist, in one of his opinions in cases like this, said, look, give them a year, after which they have to pay for the future delay. That would basically force everything out. Or to say, if you don't within a year decide that you're going to turn a permit down, it will be considered to be granted, as it was done. That forces them to actually start to make a move. And then what you have to do is to say, when you do make these kinds of moves, what you have to do is to point to something which is really serious that you're trying to protect, instead of being completely diffuse. Now, my own view on this is that the only thing that really should fall into this particular category are nuisance-like behaviors or the access that you have to get to and from public spaces, where you put the entry to the parking garage and things of that particular sort. Supreme Court has taken a larger view on this, which says the character of a neighborhood, in fact, is something you could put in there. My own view is, if you want to get a better view, you have to do what ordinary people have to do. You have to buy a restrictive covenant on somebody else's land, which requires compensation. But even if you decided that I'm wrong on that point and that the Carister standard still applies, if you really require something to point it out and for the government to give you a bill of particulars, then in effect 98% of these cases are going to start to disappear. Because what happens is, what they do is they never make a final decision on anything. And they always give you more time. And so the basic argument is, you have to exhaust your remedies, and we're going to exhaust you before you exhaust them. The late Grant Gilmore was a great professor of law, died in 1982. And he says, one of the things you can do to people is to kill them with due process. You give them more and more process, and after a while, they just plot. And so bringing an end to these kinds of things and forcing them to pay if they want to delay beyond that would, I think, sort of transform this particular business and get you out of these preposterous kinds of cases. California is becoming a completely stratified state. It is going to have the super rich who don't have to worry about these kinds of problems, and then it's going to have large numbers of people at the bottom who are drawn by the welfare magnet, and then in the middle you get all these people who want to have decent homes and so forth, and they find that if you're in $100,000 or $200,000 a year, you're a pauper in a state where a shack in a city like Palo Alto can cost you $1 million or $2 million. So the stratification, the bifurcation, the progressive situation does exactly what they've never wanted to do. It kills the middle class. And there's going to be an exit from California. I've known all sorts of people who've left in frustration because their families couldn't open a business of the sort. And it's only going to get worse with the current administration. Jerry Brown, as a governor, he was an impossible man to read. He moved left, he moved right. You never knew where he was, but he wasn't a crazy guy. I'm not so sure about Gavin Newsom and the current crowd that you get in the California legislature. So either you get federal intervention, because we know that state intervention through the courts is going to be absolutely hopeless. After all, Richard Epstein, he loses without an argument. And, you know, I now regard that as one of the strongest reasons why cert should be granted. I'm not a perfect appellate lawyer. I don't do this very often. But, boy, I'd rather argue before I lose rather than lose before I argue.
All right. Thank you, Richard. And thank you to our listeners. Remember, you can follow Richard on Twitter. That's at Richard A. Epstein. You can read his weekly column, The Libertarian, by visiting Defining Ideas at Hoover.org. And you can help us out by rating the show on iTunes. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit Hoover.org.